We'll be starting our conference today with a keynote presentation by Sharon Hill, who will be talking to us about the reasons and foundations of work in museums with their communities as social agents for change. Sharon is the director of the British Museum Association, which fosters the value of museums in society. She is a very well-known speaker in the UK and outside in all matters museums and cultural policies, and she teaches and publishes on the history, ethics, and social impact of museums. Moreover, Sharon is part of the sponsorship of the Censeres Museum and is a member of the European Museum Forum. Sharon, please take it away.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the conference organizers for inviting me, and also to the technical support for your help with the presentation today. So I'm just going to go back to get my presentation up. Okay, so thank you very much, and thank you to the translators as well. I was really interested to see the subject matter of this conference, and also to hear the opening remarks about the relevance of museums to their communities, and museums being from their communities and products of community. That's certainly something that we have been thinking a lot about and delivering with our partners in museums in the UK. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Museums Association, the organisation that I'm from, and what's happening in the UK museum sector, and some of those broader issues in society that have already been referenced. So we do live in very challenging times. Over the past 20 months, we've seen the translation from COVID to lockdown. In the UK, we've had conversations about culture wars and decolonization, and also conversations about social prescribing models, people-centered research, and hybrid and blended models. And I think the one thing that we can say probably unites us is that we're getting used to doing things differently and facing up to some of those challenges that we face in museums and that our communities face. So I'm going to talk a little bit about those issues. But one of the things that we have been thinking about 20 months into this pandemic is, what have we learned? What does that mean for the future? What does it mean for museums? And how can we connect better to our audiences and make a difference? So just to give you a little context, the Museums Association is a membership organisation. We have 10,000 individual members who work in museums, and we have 15,000 institutional members, the museums themselves. We do all the things that you would expect a membership organisation to do. We deliver content, professional development, events and policy and advocacy. But most importantly for us, over the last 5 or 6 years, we have become a campaigning organisation. We're very clear on our mission, vision, values and purpose. And one of the things that we really want to do is provide challenge to the sector to ask some of the difficult questions that we've all been wrestling with, not just in the last 20 months, but before that. So this image is on the left of Charlie Craggs, who's a trans activist. And she ran a session at one of our conferences a few years ago, a transphobia nail bar. So whilst doing the delegates' nails, she talked to them about issues of transphobia. And certainly that's one of the issues that many museums in the UK have been thinking about and addressing. But we also want to create platforms and opportunities to ask awkward and difficult questions. One of the speakers in the introduction talked about discomfort and going to places maybe that we don't want to go. And that's what we think we should do in our museums. So this image here is of the Museum Detox Group, who are a group for people of colour who work in museums in the UK. And they ran a white privilege clinic at another of our conferences, where delegates were then asked to fill in a template a form that challenged them to think about the privilege that they hold as white people in our institutions and more broadly in society. We also want to fund change, so we do funnel quite a lot of funding into the sector from various trusts and foundations. And we all know that in museums, a lot of funding could go into collections, and we do put some of that funding into collections, but we make sure it's about connecting the collection to communities so that it's got an engagement focus and a social impact outcome. Over the last 11 years, we've funded £11 million worth of collections work, and that's also in the pandemic been an emergency response where we have thought about how we can support museums, not just to survive in these challenging times, but also to keep that connection with communities, even when institutions are closed. And one of the things that we're very clear is that we can't do any of the work of challenge and asking awkward questions and social impact and community engagement without the workforce, the people who work in and with museums. So it's been our plan over the last 5 or 6 years through our professional development programmes to create and support a radical and diverse and engaged workforce. So you can see this image is from one of our conferences where the bags that you would normally get when you go to a conference to hold all of your papers were printed with the slogan Museum Activist. If anything, the pandemic has really sort of made us all stop and think about our relevance and our ability to engage. And I was really struck at the beginning of the pandemic when I read a book by Catherine Pearson about museums and the Second World War in the UK. So the image that you can see on this slide is of the Imperial War Museum in London, and you can see the bomb damage on the roof there, and the objects that have been shattered or protected by the tarpaulin. And in that book, it talks about what museums did in the UK when most of them were closed, when collections were taken out of museums for their own protection, and when museum workers had to think and rethink what role they had and how they could connect with community. And there's a quote from Dr. F.S. Wallace, who was the director of Bristol City Museum. He was also the editor of Museums Journal, which we still publish as the Museums Association. And you can see he says here, in the midst of the darkness and brutality of war, museums and art galleries have seized all the opportunities for spreading the light of learning and culture. Their amazing development has been tremendously accelerated, not retarded, as was first anticipated by war conditions. And I think a little bit of that has happened in the pandemic. Museum workers have had to rethink how we work and rethink and devise new ways of connecting with our communities and ensuring that we sustain that level of engagement. So one of the other things that we've tried to do as the Museums Association and with our members who work in museums is reflect critically on the challenges that we face and that our communities face. And to do that, we have to think about the wider context. There's something that sits underneath that picture of COVID and the pandemic. For example, the question of poverty. This image shows somebody using a food bank in the UK, and there's been a huge growth of the number of people who live in food poverty in the UK, in particular during the pandemic. So it's estimated that 30% of all children who grow up in the UK live in poverty. I'm actually joining you from a museum, the Thackeray Museum of Medicine, which is in Leeds in the north of England, but I live in London, in the East End of London. In the parliamentary constituency in which I live, 54% of children grow up in poverty. And that's in London, which is one of the richest cities in the world. And as I said, this image shows somebody using a food bank, and over 4 million people are affected by food poverty in the UK. We also know that homelessness is on the increase, not just in the UK, but in Europe as well. And it's a really visible reminder in every town and city in the UK, and I mean every town and city, that cuts to benefits, that cuts to universal credit and social services mean that people are slipping through the holes in the safety net. And again, we've seen a sharp increase in homelessness due to the impact of the pandemic. And of course, everyone's eyes, I'm sure, were on COP26, the Conference of the Parties in Glasgow a few weeks ago. And that really highlighted that we live at a time of climate crisis. And I've stopped using the phrase climate change because it's not just change. It's not just incremental changes. It's a crisis. So, for example, every minute, one truck worth of rubbish is dumped into the world's oceans. Most of it is plastic. Most of it is going nowhere. And the stats are endless and quite disastrous. And the other factor that is context is that we live in an increasing time of intolerance and division. Obviously, we had the Brexit referendum in the UK that was hugely divisive, and we are now having to cope with the fallout of culture wars and their impact on museums. And in 2020, we also saw the murder of George Floyd. And museums across the UK responded last year with statements of support for the Black Lives Matter movement and of anti-racism. And that was great. But what we need to do is make sure that those words are turned into actions. So we've been providing resources and support for museums through our workforce programmes and through our content to support them to tackle racism. And we've been working with organisations such as Culture and Museum Detox and the Black British Museum to encourage a wider constituency of museums to work with their local communities and anti-racism organisations. And we see a really direct connection between some of the collections that we hold in our museums, the collections of empire and colony, and racism in contemporary society today. So this image is from the Black Lives Matter protest in the city of Bristol. And what you see is an empty plinth. And on that statue was on that plinth was a statue of Edward Colston, who was a slave trader who was from that city, built his empire in that city as a result of his holding of enslaved peoples. And at the time of the Black Lives Matter protests and demonstrations in that city, the statue was torn down and thrown into the harbour. Interestingly, it was retrieved subsequently from the harbour and has been redisplayed in Bristol City Museums as a way of talking about the protest, talking about racism in society, and unlocking those conversations that need to take place about racism. So as the Museums Association, our mission is very clearly that we are inspiring museums to change lives. Our vision for the sector is for inclusive, participatory and sustainable museums at the heart of their communities. And our values are centred on inclusivity, diversity and equality. As I say, it's been a difficult 20 months. So whilst we would campaign for museums to be more relevant and engage with their communities, we also understand what has happened to the museum sector. We've recorded 4,500 redundancies in the sector. And we know from our research that local authority funding for local museums has declined by 30% in the past 10 years. So as well as campaigning for museums to be more relevant and supporting them to be more relevant, we've been busy making the case for museums and advocating for museums. And our main call is for a cultural recovery with museums at the heart of that, because we know museums can bring people back into towns and cities and rebuild community confidence when it's safe to do so. We know museums can support community recovery and well-being, which is a really critical role for museums to play. And we know that museums can help us understand the events of the past year, the past 20 months, and help us to plan for a better, different future. So our advocacy is linked to our values. One of our flagship campaigns is Museums Change Lives, and that to us really encapsulates the social purpose of museums, and we think it's needed now more than ever. So that has three simple tenets: that museums enhance health and well-being, museums can create better places for us to live and work, and museums can create space for us to have some of the difficult and challenging conversations that we need to have about society and to understand and reflect on what has happened within society. But that's not our only campaign. Last year in 2019, we published our Learning and Engagement Manifesto, which has 8 simple points. The first one is on cultural rights and cultural democracy, which recognises that access and participation in culture is a basic human right. Then we have social justice, which says that museums have a responsibility to work with their communities to overcome the challenges of poverty. Activism, which is an interesting one, and I'm quite happy to take questions on any of this, but it's certainly something that we've been talking about much more in the museum sector in the UK. And it starts from the position that museums are not neutral. We aren't neutral, blank spaces, and that activism should be based on listening to and acting and delivering with our communities. Of course, there is a bullet point on community participation, which is about developing innovative models of engagement. Collections are the USP, the unique selling point of museums, but for us, it's always centered on collections being for public use and engagement. We think research and evaluation is really important, and there's a growing conversation in the UK about people-centered research that responds to the challenges, contemporary challenges in society, and provides a research agenda that is led by communities, that is driven by communities. I would say we're only at the beginning of that type of work. There's an obvious point here on partnership, and partnership's already been mentioned in this webinar, and we say in our Learning and Engagement Manifesto that partnership should be about bringing communities together and be based on the principle of equity. And finally, again, we come back to workforce, the people who work in and with museums, because we feel we need a workforce that represents all of our diverse communities and that can support the work that we need to do with our communities, that it has the right skills to be able to do that. As a Museums Association, we also hold the Code of Ethics for museums in the UK, and that's a very important document for us. It's a key area of our policy work. It's part of our value system in the sector. And obviously COVID-19 has raised lots of ethical questions. And I think that our ethics are critical in supporting how we think and behave and react in this crisis. And I mentioned the climate crisis is an area, a growing area of campaigning for us as a Museums Association, but also in the wider museum sector. We know it is critical that museums act with their communities to ensure the focus doesn't go away on this issue. And I think museums are uniquely positioned to have conversations at a local, regional, and national level with communities, but also with politicians. And importantly, we can use our collections and our spaces to facilitate that discussion. So there's a lot of big issues in society, and there's also, I've outlined our policy response, but we also look at how communities are responding and how groups in society are responding to those challenges, because we know in museums we don't have all the answers. We don't start from a position of privileged knowledge. So we've looked at what some of the activists and campaigning responses have been to the big issues. And the good news is we can take a lot of inspiration from those that are campaigning for change. So this is a group of women called Sisters Uncut who were protesting as part of the Me Too and Time's Up campaign against discrimination and violence against women and girls. You know, we know that activism can take many forms, from the, you know, the individual stand that Greta Thunberg has taken on the climate crisis, but also women coming together to make a difference, such as the women that are in the image on the bottom right there that are protesting against a lack of abortion rights in Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK. So sometimes activism can be, and campaigning can be, about taking a stand, and sometimes it might be about taking a knee. I'm sure you are all aware of the campaign by the footballer Colin Kaepernick, who 5 years ago knelt during the playing of the national anthem at a football game in the United States. And he knelt to highlight social and racial injustice that he felt had become intolerable in that country. And that taking of a knee is now internationally recognised as a symbol of protest against racism. And still in the UK, it's something that happens before football matches and other sporting events. So sometimes activism can be a bold stand, and sometimes it can be subversive, and sometimes it can be cultural. So a couple of years ago, these posters appeared in bus shelters in Brixton in South London, and they were by an advertising agency that wanted to highlight the lack of Black role models and the lack of Black opportunities for Black actors. So this is a re-envisaged Harry Potter, but with Black actors. And I thought that made the point really well, really visually, and used a cultural reference point in order to do that. We've also here got some images of, we call them blimps, but they're very big balloons that have been flown across central London over the past couple of years, some in protest against President Trump visiting the UK, and some against as a protest about the London Mayor Sadiq Khan. And I thought what was interesting about this was, this is very, you know, in your face, visceral protest. And quite a few museums said they wanted to collect these big balloons, which is great. And, you know, they should be in museum collections for sure. But I think we often default to collecting when it comes to thinking about issues in contemporary society. And I think this stuff should be in collections. But if they are collected, I would say the question is, are we using them to unlock conversations about power, about politics, about gender, about discrimination, etc.? I think that was also the case when protests have taken place in the last 5 or 6 years. Again, this is a protest by young women. We collect the placards from the demonstrations, but we need to do more than collect the ephemera. We need to use that to have conversations with young women and with young men about the issues that they think are critical and important to them. And I do think cultural reference points are interesting, and I'll come on to how that links into the museum sector. Maybe some of you saw the film Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. It was a Coen Brothers film. And it reminded me, actually, in that film, it's a one-woman protest against injustice. And it reminded me that making the campaign visible, she pays for this billboard, is especially powerful to those that feel that they don't have a voice, or that they feel that they're not being listened to. And what I thought was really interesting was when I saw that that film inspired campaigning in the UK too. So these lorries were driven around central London a couple of years ago when the inquiry into the Grenfell fire opened. So the Grenfell fire was the horrendous tragedy of the fire in the tower block where over 80 people were killed. And the protesters at the opening of the public inquiry drove these lorries around central London, and they say on them, 71 dead and still no arrests. How come? So you can see how cultural objects and images have power and resonance for people when they are calling out injustice or wanting to make the point. And I suppose the part, my point is that all of this context impacts us. We cannot and do not exist in a bubble, in a museum, outside of what's going on in society. And my question is, can we provide the emotional and intellectual space in the museum sector to have those challenging, interesting, diverse conversations and engagements with our communities? Because if we don't ask those questions and have those conversations, the campaign will come to the museum. So for a couple of years, the Natural History Museum in London has been touring at what it calls Dippy, the dinosaur skeleton, to museums across the UK. A great initiative to share that iconic museum object with as wide a range of audiences as possible. So here it is in Kelvin Grove Museum in Glasgow, and protesters are demonstrating by having a die-in to highlight the link between the extinction of the dinosaurs and the climate crisis that is taking place now, and the extinction of species which takes place now, which I thought, you know, raised some really interesting questions as the museum, as a site for protest and campaigning. In particular, do we embrace this campaign within our institutions, or do we withdraw from it and move away from the idea of that campaign? When that dinosaur skeleton went to Wales, it was at the time of the climate strikes. So the National Museum of Wales in Cardiff became the focal point of the climate strike in 2019. So the image that you see on the left here is on the steps of the museum, and that's the mainly young people protesting in the climate strike. And what the staff in the museum did, which you can see on the image on the right here, is brought out their collections, in particular their natural history specimens, to show the extinction of species, which has happened over many hundreds and hundreds of years, which is evidenced in their collections, and also brought out their own placards in response to the climate emergency, and opened up a conversation with young people about how they might interpret the collections, and allowed them access to that, so that when Dippy the dinosaur was in the Great Hall of the National Museum in Cardiff, their interpretation, the young people's interpretation, was alongside it. One other area that, again, I've referred to and that I think is really interesting is this growing idea of museum activism, museums really wanting to make a difference. I work with the Museum of Homelessness, which is a very small, young charity. It's very new. And at the beginning of the pandemic, whilst we've always worked with people who are homeless, we said, what is it? What can we do? What can we do to make a difference? And we did three things. We campaigned for an everyone in policy, which brings people off the streets into temporary accommodation during the pandemic. And we were successful in achieving that. We collected the stories of people's experience during the pandemic, and we delivered food to people who were still on the streets and were in temporary accommodation. This image is from an annual vigil that takes place every year to commemorate and remember people who've died homeless. So that's a really kind of active museum that is probably at the forefront of making change. And I just wanted to highlight some of the resources that we have freely available on our website. Some of it's translated, some of it's not. This is a toolkit for measuring socially engaged practice. So we know sometimes we have to demonstrate to ourselves and to our funders and to our stakeholders the difference that we're making. So this toolkit would, I hope, help you on your journey towards demonstrating that impact and the difference that we can make working with our communities. And we also have, and it's one of the things I wanted to talk to, a power to the people framework. So this is a self-assessment framework, which should hopefully take people who work in museums and institutions on a journey through how participatory and how well they can work with their communities. It was developed in 2018 from a UK-wide steering group, And it has some basic principles within it that we're doing work with communities rather than doing it to communities or for communities. That community involvement in decision making goes wider than just the project. It goes to the whole organisation. That it starts with a people-centred approach, and also that it gives that clear and equitable voice to people outside of the institution. And we've used this as a tool also to advocate why it matters, because it has a positive impact on the health and well-being of all those that are involved, and it generates new and exciting opportunities and creates a positive impression with stakeholders. So you can see in this slide, there's four sections. So there's, if you're starting off with participatory practice and engaging your communities, there's the stage that you get to next where you're making progress, there's best practice, and then there's those organisations that are leading and championing in this area. I mean, I'm sure it's exactly the same in your areas that you've joined from today, that sometimes the work is led by the money and can be delivered on a project basis, which has a beginning and an end. And that's very frustrating for people who work in museums, and it's even more frustrating for the communities that we work with. And so this is about really embedding this practice in every area of work. So this section is on mission, vision and value, mission, values and vision. And it's really important because it's about how it's written into our mission statements, but then actively adopted. So if you're leading and championing in this area, then your mission statement actively promotes it. It's understood by staff and trustees, and it's a way of delivering and championing the work. And it goes across all sorts of areas of the work of a museum. So it's not just contained in the community engagement or the learning and engagement teams or staff. Importantly, it talks about leadership and governance, because we all know, I'm sure, that you need to have the leaders and those governing bodies engaged for any area of museum work to be delivered effectively. And that's in particular the case with community engagement. So that might be about gauging where the organisation is at and where you want to make progress. I think too often engagement and community work is seen as peripheral. It's seen as something that's nice to have, and we want to make it core and ensure that leadership and governance have got absolute buy-in and ownership of that area of practice. There's also a section on commitment, about it being written into policies and enacted. And you can see there's a question asked under each of the headings: is it written into policies and enacted? And we know that not every museum will be at the same space on all of these questions. It's a way of supporting and developing the work, and to make sure that it's embedded. And then this one, I think, is a really important one, and it's who has a say in which areas. And again, it's, you know, at what level do communities have a say in the running of the museum? I was excited to hear that you're going to have community partners speak over the course of the next 2 days. And it's important that when you're working through this process of community engagement, we found that it's when it gets to the management decision making and budgets, that's where the real power lies, and that's where communities need agency. And then there's a section as well on workforce and professional development, ensuring that organisations think about how they work with their communities and how communities are engaged and developed. There's also a growing conversation in the UK about whether we pay for lived experience and expertise, so that we know that our communities bring their own lived experience into the museum space, and they bring their expertise. So are we recognising that in payments? But this also covers job descriptions and person specifications, and making sure that all members of staff, including leadership and trustees and volunteers, have community participation written into their job descriptions. And the last section is on evaluation and evidence of change. Are we learning from what we do? And there's a whole conversation here about reflective practice and reflective thinking, which is thinking about your work experience to improve the way that you work, but doing that with your community, which we feel is really important. And so we've supported museums in the UK to develop reflective practice among staff and community partners and those that they engage with. And I suppose what I would say, it's all available on our website. What I would say in reflection myself is, you know, sometimes in museums we talk about hard to reach communities, those that don't come through the door, those that we don't even reach through our outreach programs. But I don't think there is any such thing as a hard to reach community. They're just easy to ignore if we're not looking in the right places. So we need to do more than outreach. We need to bring people into the museum space, provide space for everyone. And that's across a whole range of different community organisations. Just to flip back to this image on this slide here, this is of Swansea Waterfront Museum. And it had an outreach program to work with refugee children and their families. And instead of starting from the point of view of come into the museum, come to the exhibition, come to the galleries, this is what we provide for you, they asked the families what they wanted. And the families wanted space for their children to have a ballet class. And so that's what the museum provided. And I think that's a really good example of a museum listening first, asking the question, listening, and then acting on that. So there's lots of different ways that museums can hand over control. This image, and accept that we don't know and we're not the experts on our communities and what they want. This image is from a museum in the south of England that ran several sessions with the parents of children with special needs. And the sessions were there for the parents and carers to design the programs that they needed for their families and their children in that museum and in other museums in the local area. Again, a really good example of a museum not saying this is what we provide for you, asking the question, what do you need? And then listening to the answer and then delivering that across a variety of museums. And really, really important group to engage with, those parents who are isolated and don't always have access for them and their families to those resources. And sometimes it is about taking it outside of the walls of the museum. We have seen more and more museums right across the UK taking part in LGBTQ pride campaigns and protests and celebrations. So the bottom left is LGBTQ plus museum workers and their allies on the London Pride demonstration. And the top right is museum workers and their allies on the Cardiff Pride. And I think what's significant about these is it's a very public and visceral demonstration of allyship and support, but also it really helps that advocacy and profile for museums and their collections. They have used it, and they use the phrase getting Cardiff's history out of the closet as a way of saying we have the objects, we have the history of LGBTQ communities, and we work with those communities in order to tell those stories and to interpret them. Working well with communities on co-production is something we have lots of examples of. This is a really nice one, again, at National Museum Wales, an exhibition called Who Decides? And it was curated by the Woolwich Community Group, which is people who are homeless or have lived experience of homelessness. And they curated the exhibition that they wanted to see that reflected their experience, their taste, their ideas, their creativity in the main spaces of the National Museum there in Wales. And it is about museums becoming relevant as well, as one of the first speakers said, becoming more inclusive and relevant. This image is from an exhibition in Bolton in the north of England. In 2014, the national press in the UK reported that Bolton had some of the worst rates of hate crime in the whole of the UK. So staff at Bolton Museums decided they wanted to do something about it, and they worked with local community groups and LGBTQ groups and anti-racism groups to create a safe and inclusive space in the museum. And one of the staff members said the best comment she had heard was from a teenager who sat in the exhibition, which was called Desire, Love and Identity. And the teenager said, "This feels like the safest space in Bolton for me." And I think that's a real testimony to the difference that we can make with our places. So even if a collection is small and doesn't have a permanent space like the Museum of Homelessness, it can still really make a big difference. Everything that we collect at the Museum of Homelessness, every object is collected with the story of the person who's donating it. And all of the objects that are donated to us through that object story programme, we are only the temporary custodians. If any member of the community wants them back, we hand them back straight away. We have a duty to collect those stories, but a duty to our community as well. So I said I'm sitting in the Thackeray Museum of Medicine in Leeds. It was the first museum in the UK to operate as a vaccination centre in the UK. It is attached physically as a building to the local hospital, but we operated as a vaccination centre. And I thought it was really interesting. It was shortlisted for the Museum of the Year Award this year, which is a big prize in the UK of £100,000. But all of the shortlisted museums were doing really embedded community participatory work over the course of the pandemic. I just want to finish on the last couple of slides. This is our Empowering Collections report from 2018, where we spoke to 1,000 people in the sector and asked them how they wanted us to help them work with collections. And one of the things that they really wanted to prioritise, as well as engage community work, was the idea of decolonisation. Now, I realise this might be a bit of a UK-specific conversation, although I know there are other museums and other countries in Europe that are thinking about decolonisation and the role of empire. But on the back of that report, we have just published our Supporting Decolonisation in Museums guidance. And that has a really powerful piece of participatory work that supports engaged work with communities. In museums in the UK, it's about examining the relationship between collections and buildings and ways of amassing knowledge and archives, and unpicking that to expose how the collections got into the museums as a result of empire, why they were collected and what their contemporary relevance is. And I think that's a normal part of what museums do, interpreting, reinterpreting, drawing new and different stories out, working with communities to include their voice. And it might lead to return of objects, redisplay, or in the case of sensitive material, objects being taken off display. But it's always about the conversation, about the dialogue, about the listening, and about the people-centred research. Again, this is available on our website, but it's based on a number of principles that run through all of the work that we support, that museums are not neutral spaces, that colonial values and bias are embedded in many institutions, that we have to acknowledge our power and privilege within the sector. We have the privilege of working with collections. We have power because we have that institutional knowledge and the institutional power. That building relationships takes time and it has to be done on a sustainable basis. That we value all forms of knowledge and expertise equally. And that's quite hard for us to do in museums sometimes, because sometimes we think we know it all. We don't. And we bring that expertise into our institutions. It is sometimes about being brave. And I think this was referenced earlier as well, but also being accountable to communities, getting on and doing the work, not just talking about it, being creative, which is something we can provide with our spaces and our collections, and aiming for justice. And I'll finish on this last slide, which is an image from the Secret Museum, which was the latest project of the Museum of Homelessness. And the idea that lots of us have turned to online delivery over the past 20 months, and I think there's huge potential in our hybrid and blended offer. And I truly believe we can reach wider and deeper than we ever had before. The caveat is that all the research will tell you that if people weren't engaged before the pandemic, they won't engage in a digital offer and they won't engage afterwards unless we address some of the inequalities unless we really take on embedding community and participatory practice. So whatever the models, we need to hold on to the innovation that's been created over the last 20 months and use this opportunity to rethink what a museum is as a relevant organisation, as an organisation created from community, owned by community. This last year, the amazing work that many museums has done has been a real inspiration for me, and it's continued to give me hope in some of the dark days that we've always been through. As I said, this was one of the last exhibitions I attended, the Secret Museum, which was part of the Museum of Homelessness response to the pandemic. So it was items that were collected by the museum from people who were homeless, with people who were homeless during the pandemic. And it was absolutely astonishing. It was soulful, it was hard-hitting, it was joyful, it was transformative. And most importantly, it was people-centered. It was everything that a museum should be, collected and curated together with people with lived experience of homelessness and absolutely focused on community. Thank you.
Moltes gràcies, Sharon, per aquesta presentació.
Thank you, Sharon, for this amazing and powerful presentation and so clear and showing that museums and the future of museums is really about becoming implicated in people's concerns. We really need to think on the things that really concern citizens and society. We have a couple of questions, which I will be passing on right away. Xavier asks, do you think that these community partners ought to be present in the museum management, in debates about strategy? And in that case, what ought to be their role in this environment?
That's a really, really good question. It's really relevant to the conversations we're having in some museums in the UK. So yes, I think we would say it has to be in every area of decision-making throughout the museum. And there's a really interesting conversation opening up about the difference between consultation and collaboration. So, you know, quite often I think museums will consult with community about big decisions, about some of the strategic outcomes or their, you know, their strategic frameworks. But that is just quite a passive consultation with some options. Do you like this? Do you like this? Do you want this? Whereas genuine collaboration is about saying, well, what do we want to create? What does the framework look like? What does the strategic view look like? What is our mission as an organisation? So there's that kind of bottom-up feel from it. And I think I would say it's rare that it's at the kind of very high level of strategic decision-making, but there are institutions that are seeking to involve and collaborate with community at every step on the journey, rather than doing that kind of passive top-down thing.
Perdó, em sembla que no tenia...
I'm sorry, I think I was muted. Okay, so I'll ask the question again. Eva Jouvet asks, how do you ask your communities? How do you talk with them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And sometimes I think even with organisations, with museums that do good community engagement work, you end up working with what we would call the usual suspects, the community groups that you always go to because you know the people who are involved and you know you can get a good response and you know that they'll work well with you. So again, I think it has to start from internally in the museum, thinking about, well, you know, what is our vision for the museum? What is our mission? How are we going to enact that? And then in order to do that, which communities do we want to work with? Which communities do we already work with? And which communities have we never worked with? And doing that audit process and then going physically outside of the museum or bringing communities into the museum space to ask what their issues are and what they want to see. There's kind of like a passive model where you bring people in and you say, we've already thought of these ideas. this is what we're doing, do you agree? Or there's a really collaborative model where you say, come into the space or we'll come to your spaces. We want to know what your issues are. We want to know what your interest areas are. We want to know what the history of your communities is. We want to know what the contemporary issues are that you're engaged with. So please, please work with us on that basis. So it's the proactive or the reactive response. And I would say that the museums that are doing it really well in terms of being proactive are really reaching out to communities. I know here at the Thackeray Museum of Medicine, just undergone a capital transformation redevelopment project, reopened in the middle of a pandemic. But we've taken real steps to keep the connections with communities during that capital project, and also to reach out now to new communities that have never crossed the thresholds of the institution. It's a really massively diverse area of the city, right where the museum is. So to bring those communities in and to proactively work with them. But that was like the strategic vision was to do that. And then it was working out how the delivery of that could happen with the community partners.
Luis Xavier Flores pregunta el següent.
Luis Xavier Flores asks the following. Oh, there's a bit of a debate in the chat going on. And the question is, what do you think about volunteers in museums? I worked at the Centre d'Histoire in Montreal, where they wanted to explain the multicultural history to the city's current communities. And it was all white French-speaking workers, and they were not accepting volunteers. And I was wondering, how can you reach communities when they don't think they're represented in people from those communities, whether they're workers or volunteers at the museum, which I think might be an option? It's not about just an integrating speech, but to physically include these communities.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, well, certainly it is the case in the UK that our workforce...
Es una muy buena pregunta y desde luego es algo que vemos en el Reino Unido.
Oh, hang on, sorry, I couldn't hear that. Oh, I could hear the translation then. It's certainly the case in the UK that our workforce, the people who are paid to work in museums, don't represent the diversity of our communities. So we are quite white. We're mainly women, mainly middle class, able-bodied. So there's a very, there's a lack of diversity in our workforce. It's a recognised problem and issue. And I would say up until the pandemic, a lot of our volunteers were of a similar demographic. And reflected the workforce. So we are quite monocultural in our volunteers and our workforce. And that's a problem, because what communities will tell you is if we can't see ourselves in that institution, then we don't think you will take our issues seriously, or that you will know enough about our issues to be able to represent us or engage us. So we do have to deal with the issue around workforce and volunteers. What I would say is that the museums that have got it right in terms of volunteers have deliberately and strategically thought about diversification of volunteers and gone to community, deliberately to community groups, advertised the volunteering opportunities transparently and worked with those community groups to bring in a diversity of volunteers. I think there's still a job of work to be done in terms of the workforce. And, we've run traineeships and we have supported some of the networks that are for non-white museum workers in order to support them to carry on working in the sector. But it's not resolved, and it is an issue because it provides a disconnect between the workforce in the museum and the volunteers and what real communities look like.
Hi ha dues preguntes més. L'Antoni Laporte agraeix la teva xerrada.
We have two more questions. Antoni Laporte thanks you for this inspiring talk. And the question is, how can we stimulate the museum workforce to be more representative in society? For instance, in our museums in Catalonia and Spain, the presence of the huge amount of immigration that we've received over the past few years is only testimonial, except for like the cleaning stuff.
Mm. Yeah, well, that is, you know, in many ways, it's the same in the UK. The only diversity is that sometimes the front of house workers, the lower paid positions, or those that are doing catering or cleaning operations. And obviously that those are traditionally not the jobs that are influential within the institution either. So they aren't the people who are getting to make the decisions. I would say that if you have diversity in your front of house and your other roles in the organisation, then an easy way of changing the power dynamic is involving the staff that you've already got who are diverse in the decision making in the institution. So put the people who are diverse in the heart, that already work for your institution, in the heart of the decision making. So we're working with a network called Front of House Museums, which is a network for people who work front of house in museums. And we're just developing, we're about to launch a charter for change, which is about, it's a charter program to change the way that front of house museum staff are viewed. And interestingly, the two things that, well, I mean, you know, they've talked about terms and conditions, pay, et cetera, all the rest of it. But the two things that they really wanted to see in that charter was, one, recognition and value the role that front of house museum staff do, and all other staff, non-curatorial staff. And the other is involve us in decision making. We're interested in the running of the organisation. We're from communities outside of the institution, and we're interested in the future of those institutions and what exhibitions they might put on. So there's something that you can do with the front of house museums staff in that area. But then in terms of changing the workforce, there has to be something about entry level. So those first jobs that people get. So I know some of you were probably from universities. In the UK, it's definitely the case that there's lots of museum studies course or heritage courses. And most people come to the first job in the sector with two degrees, a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And that prevents diversity. It mitigates against diversity. It mitigates against representation. So we've still got to do it in the UK. We have to kind of change the model of getting your first steps on the career ladder. We have to make it interesting and exciting and viable for people to want to work in museums, and not just the usual suspects of the people that we know work in museums. And I'd say we have to, you know, do things like traineeships and apprenticeship schemes, and bringing people into the space through volunteer routes, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to kind of disrupt the workforce at lots of different levels in order to diversify and make it more representative of the communities.
Anem una mica justos de temps, però hi ha dues preguntes més.
We're not doing great for time, but we have two more questions. Let's see if we have time. Oriol Pasqual asks, with regards to the kind of activities that you do in collaboration with communities, does anything go, even if they're completely unrelated to our connections or to our mission? I'm saying this because Catalonia, for instance, has these so-called civic centers, which are locally rooted centers and specialized in cultural devotion, in cultural activities, whose proceedings are very different to a museum. So I understand Uriel's question goes along the lines that these civic centers already have that are already doing that kind of work.
So yeah, I completely understand the question and where it's coming from. I would say in the UK, maybe the structure is slightly different. So there are small local community centers that are very, very localized, and they would be based on a sort of geographic locality, so they wouldn't be based on a cultural community, and they wouldn't be cultural community centers. I'm not denigrating or downplaying their role, but I don't think they operate in the same way that the civic centers that you described do. And so in effect, museums quite often are the only central public space in a town or a city where you could provide that space for community to come together. So in that situation, we've been making the case, and museums have been holding the throwing open those spaces to communities. So in the case of Swansea with the refugee families where they wanted space for ballet lessons and ballet classes, yes, I would say yes, if that's what they want to do, that's what they should, you know, that's what you should make the space available to do. Because as they're coming in through the museum, they're not coming into just an empty room, they're coming through the exhibitions, they're coming through the learning spaces, they're seeing the objects, and it's making people feel comfortable in the space. Not everybody feels that they have the right to walk through the doors of the institution, or that they'll be welcome through the doors of the institution. So I think programmes that provide space and bring people in different ways can, whether they're related to the collection or not, can make just break down that barrier and make people feel welcome in the space and overcome some of those barriers to coming into the institution at a sort of basic level.
Plantejaré la última pregunta de Manu Escusas.
I'll be asking the last question, and I'm sorry because we still have a couple left, but we're doing awfully for time. So Jordi Girame asks, do museum teams have mediators to establish a direct dialogue with the communities? Who mediates and how, and what is the procedure? And I just wanted to ask something, because Irma Bosch, she'll be presenting her experience at the Museum of Immigration. She answered in the chat that they created this figure of the public agent. So basically, part of the audiences participate actively into projects from time to time. And the participation and the diversity of this personnel is rendered visible. So the question is this, do you have mediators to establish this community?
So it really varies from museum to museum, depending on how engaged that museum is traditionally with its community. So I think rarely, in some cases, there would be a third-party mediator. I mean, I think it's a fantastic idea, actually. It's certainly something I would take on board for learning from the conversation that we're having today. What more often happens is that a member of staff on the museum team will be responsible for community engagement, or will be somebody who works with communities. I think there's a growing model from some more arts museum organisations to have what they call community producers. So these are people who are from the community who then do play a producer role within the institution. So they might do that, like it might be a young people's team of community producers, or it might be based on ethnicity or other characteristics, but they come from outside and work within the museum. So yeah, I think there's probably a role for all three: the traditional community engagement person, the community producers that are coming in and producing within the museum, and then the intermediary person who are providing that bridge between the museum and the community.
Perfecta, don Sharon.
Thank you, that's great. Well, Sharon, thank you so much again for being here for your presentation, which was amazing.